My name is Christopher Wallach. I'll just kick it off. How about that? After I take a drink of water. So for those of you who just came in the room, what we were just before we started the session, we were having a conversation around why are you here? What are you trying to, you know, what do you hope to get out of this session? And that's for my benefit, quite frankly. I love talking with customers, people, consumers of the product, how you're using it, what your future plans are, hearing what your needs are, and then whether or not we can meet those needs, but if we're not meeting those needs, why not, right? How can we change the product to get there? So with that being said, let's kick this off. This is Link Securing External Access. My name is Christopher Wallach. I'm a solutions architect with Microsoft's Enterprise Communications Global Practice. And what's my job, I don't sell anything, and I don't support anything. What I do is try to work with customers, and that's why I say I'm very interested in speaking with people about how you, as implementers of technology, enable your business, because that's your customer, on using technology, right? So what are the services and features that you enable for them to do their business? Because I think we all understand, are there any business people in here? Okay, that's what I thought. So we're pretty much all technical people, right? So I think, and I'm going to go really quickly. There's a lot of slides in here. So I'm going to try and get to the meat, the deep technical stuff when we talk about what happened to TMG, what are some of the things that we can do as we move forward. This is all about not necessarily products, so not necessarily Link. This is about Link. But where it's going is how are you going to enable this for your users, right? Our IT budgets are shrinking, and they always have. They will continue to do so because it's, you know, the whole idea of IT is it's just a commodity, right? It's like the telephone. You have a telephone in your house, you pay a service for it. So that's everyday life, march to the cloud. So, but that's a whole nother presentation. So today, we're going to talk about perimeter solutions, media relay, reverse proxy, two-factor authentication. And I'm going to try, no, I'm not going to try. I said this before, I don't really stay on script very well. So I hopefully will not bore you by death by PowerPoint. But the thing that Microsoft believes, understands, because from my perspective, it's a fact, is that Link is secure. It's a secure application. It's a secure service for what you're doing, right? We talk about TMG, and we're going to talk about TMG. We're going to talk about media relay, reverse proxy, and two-factor authentication. And we're going to talk about what to do now that TMG is all grown up. And where do we go from here? So perimeter solutions. The Link perimeter, this is the recommended topology, right? So this is the default configuration if you were going to look at, you know, any kind of a reference architecture, go up to TechNet and look at that. This is what you're going to see with regard to your edge or your perimeter. We have... The topology has an internet side, a perimeter side, an internal. So by show of hands, how many of you think that the perimeter should be there or is necessary? Show of hands. Okay. And would that be because you already have implemented a perimeter, you have a reverse proxy, or that from a security perspective, you have a policy, a business policy or technical policy that says you will not... Thou shalt not allow external access to internal configuration items. Yeah. Second one? Okay. So that's the world where I'm at, right? So when we have conversations in the future, hopefully we'll have conversations in the future, when we talk technology, I will always ask, what's the business driver for this? Because oftentimes technology for technology's sake has been done, and it's been done a lot. This is really cool. I personally have done it. There's several stories I could tell you where I did that and looked back on it and said, I really didn't need to do that. So I would agree with you. I mean, the perimeter at this stage in the game, but we're asking ourselves, how are we fundamentally, the services that we're offering externally, how are we going to manage those services? How are we going to authenticate the consumers of those service? And then what are we going to authorize those users to access? See, I just went off script. So authentication methods, we're going to connect through the access server, and we're going to use a reverse proxy. We're going to talk about, let's just get into it. Let's go. Link directors. Who here has implemented Link Director? Director Pool? Regardless of whether it's Link 2010 or Link 2013, do you believe that Link Directors are required, not so required, are they required in your environment or in your environment? Why, can I ask what was the requirement for the director? Why did you install the director? Is that Link 2010?
Yes, and so it was for a customer. And so it was their requirement as a protection mechanism against DOS attacks and authentication.
Okay, and you, sir?
Yeah, it's something I'm trying to, I want to put in place this week. It's pretty much because of DOS attack. We have a huge external access, right? For you, a lot of users like to access and link external. Right? Mm-hmm.
You're providing a layer of obfuscation there.
Correct.
Okay.
Just
right. So, I'm not. And the whole intent of this is to say, because when Link 2013 came out, the director pool is optional. There's other mechanisms that you could use for that. The intent of this slide is not for me to say it's good or bad or otherwise, but to do what we just did and say what are the technical reasons what are the business reasons behind your implementation of a director pool. And those are very valid, right? So that you supported topologies, obviously directors are no longer required. It's additional hardware, but these are the give and takes of it. So, but the added value, where you see limited, right? What our product group is doing with regard to Link, and then the next iteration of Link as it's coming out, in addition to Office 365, is to ask questions. What are the requirements for this? The perimeter, because I asked that question earlier, as well as the director, and say, are these necessary? Can we protect against those kinds of things without a director pool? Can we do that in some other way? And the intent is to simplify the design, right, from an architecture perspective. Remote access through VPN. So, who here requires remote access through VPN? Okay, so you've actually just eliminated the edge. You go right through. Okay. And that's also, there's a lot of people who stand up here and say, oh, well, that's not optimal. That's not best practice. It is best practice because it's effective for you. You have a requirement for that. And that's why it's supported. So the impact, obviously, there are considerations to the service impact, right? Because you're encapsulating that traffic, you're going in and out, you're requiring your external users to open that VPN tunnel. We'll talk about direct access and media relay. So media relay. The terms we're going to talk about when we talk about media relay are what is termed a candidate, ICE, stun, and turn. So a lot of you are probably already very familiar with these acronyms or terms, ICE being the Interactive Connectivity Establishment, STUN, the simple traversal of UDP through NAT, and TURN is the traversal using relay NAT. You see the session traversal utilities for NAT? This is one thing at Microsoft that I'm not on a rant for. I think I'm trying to evangelize. I do not like using acronyms in presentations or even when I talk to people, because if I don't say simple traversal of UDP through NAT, or if I just start throwing acronyms and you don't know, the person I'm talking to doesn't know, it's kind of a, is that person going to say, well, I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're saying? I'm not a big acronym fan. But these words have meanings. and they're very important. A candidate is a possible combination of IP address and port over media channel. We're going to look at that and why that's important for Media Relay. So here's the challenge. You have Alice and you have Bob and a registrar. So both Alice and Bob are isolated over from a corporate firewall. So there's a signaling and media portion of their traffic, right? So the SIP proxy is going to be used to proxy their SIP traffic to the registrar. And then there's the media element of it. So when we introduce NAT, that causes an issue with regard to that point-to-point media traffic. And then, of course, if Charlie joins the conversation, everything just goes to hell in a handbasket. So the challenge for NAT, or network address translation function, the function of NAT is to translate one or more internal addresses to one external address, and it's also to allow connections from private networks to public networks, and then or block connections. The trade-off is security versus usability. It's complex to implement. It blocks unwanted traffic, but it might also block wanted traffic. I've seen that a lot, where NAT has already been implemented and someone goes to implement Link on top of that, and there's a troubleshooting exercise that goes through trying to make it fit through that round hole. The second challenge is corporate firewalls. So there's more, corporate firewalls have more, scrutinize the traffic a bit more, but the goals are similar, right? They want to share IP addressing and control the data flow going back and forth. Where we've seen issue here is where you have two internal firewalls that are isolating users, whether that be internal or external, that gets to be problematic from a troubleshooting perspective. So the signaling solution for a SIP proxy is that if when you introduce a SIP proxy, it's reachable on the internet and it processes all SIP traffic. So when we put all that together, right, we're saying signaling uses SIP proxy, media flow over a separate channel, and then the pre-ICE endpoints use local IPs and ports. So we can see here where the SIP traffic is going across. There's the external to internal, the SIP proxy's there, right? And the thing to understand here is that the pre-ICE endpoints use local IPs and ports, and we talk about that candidate. We'll look at that here in a second. But no media can be sent between A and W. So the solution is ICE Extend and Turn. So we're going to add an AV Edge server so that Stun reflects NAT addresses to B&E. Turn relays the media packets C, D, X, and Y. And this is where we get into those candidates, right? Remember what those candidates are. And then ICE exchanges candidates determines the optimal media path. So the candidates are the best combination pairs. Does that make sense? Is that... So all three protocols are based on the IETF standards and drafts. That's important to understand as well. We want to make this as standardized as possible. So the Link Edge server and the topology, again, this is what you're going to see. This is the generic. If you go out to TechNet, you're going to see this. So the ICE endpoints are clients and servers, the terminates media, audio, video, desktop application sharing, one-on-one file transfer, that kind of thing. And then your edge components are going to be the ones that provide Stun and Turn, does the media transversal. So there's five five phases of ICE. During the sign-in, it's requesting a token. So are you familiar with MRAS? Anyone familiar with MRAS? So we're getting into that point of, what do we do when Team G, that's coming up here pretty soon. And I hope I'm not rushing through this, but I am going to go a bit fast because this deck has 50 slides. So I'm going to get to beginning of the juicy part. So during the sign-in, the requesting token for MRAS is Media Relay Authentication Service. And this is what we're going to be inserting that's going to help us through this whole process. So when establishing a call, candidate discover the five phases or the sign-in process, and then the discovery exchange, the connectivity checks, and then this the candidate promotion. Remember, the candidates are the best pairs of the solution. So what does that look like? Candidate credentials for a remote client. So the endpoint attempts to register, so it sends a SIP register to the Access Edge, forwards that to the front end. The front end sends back a 200 OK with the information for the remote user for login and MRES. Then the SIP service request goes back through the Access Edge to the front end, that then sends back that information with the username and password that it's using, that it will use to attest to MRES. And then the service is requesting the media relay. Then the AV Edge comes back with a 200 OK. So the MRES is going to be that element within your Access Edge that's going to be doing the authentication for credentials for remote clients. So your anonymous user, and I'm going to back up, it's going to be talked about here in a bit, but what we're talking about is externalizing services to users, and I need to be very clear here, users being those people within your organization that are authenticated within your organization, they have a user object or user account, unauthenticated users and guests, right? You're going to have people accessing information, data, internal to your organization, and you need to either A, authorize them or not authorize them. If they're not authorized, you can still give them access, but you're going to restrict, or I should say, there's authentication is the word I should use in the beginning. You're going to authenticate them. If they're unauthenticated, which means they're anonymous or guest, then you're going to authorize the information or the data that they're going to have access to. Will they have the ability to do application sharing? Will they have the ability to do presence lookup? All these kinds of things you're going to have to make choices on, whether you're going to, for your unauthenticated users, unauthenticated individuals coming in, those requests, what access they're going to have. So you may have a service desk that has a bot, a link-enabled, you know, a UCMA, UCWA bot that sits on the outside that my mom clicks on and says, hey, Mr. Organization, my PC went down. I need help. She thinks she's talking to a person. She's talking to a bot. The bot then forwards that to a CSR internally to your organization and then instantiates a web or a video session between my mom and this person. Does my mom have Link? No. Does she have Skype? Yes, but that's irrelevant. She's gone to your website, and she's clicked on, I need help, and she's now in a video conversation with your CSR. That's what we're talking about here. So credentials for anonymous users, same kind of thing as a SIP invite. At this instance, the service is going to go back to the MRES service and request. It's going to get a 200 OK. Then it's going to send off the 200 OK externally with the appropriate information for the candidate information, ports, IPs, user information, token. So the discovery, did that make sense, by the way? Let me back up. I don't want to glaze over that. Does this make sense, everybody? Okay. And if my contact information is here at the end of this, and once you go home, if you think of a question, feel free to email me. I am me, what have you. If you can't tell, I'm a little bit passionate about this kind of, you know, communications-enabled business process, and I would love to hear from you if there's something that you need help with. If I don't have an answer, because I'll be the first one to tell you if I don't know something, I don't know, but I'll put you in contact with someone who does. So address discovery for audio and video. You have an endpoint, A, that sends out an allocated UDP through the NAT firewall to the AV Edge. Then it also sends out an allocated TCP from D to E. Now, with the address exchange, what we see is that the SIP invite, you see those the numbers underneath? Those are the candidate pairs. SIP invite goes out. So you see the candidate pairs, A, B, C, D, E, V. And what this is doing is it's saying IP address, port, those are the candidate pairs. What are the best way to communicate with you? So a 183 session progress comes back. And these are the SIP messages that come across. So the SIP invite says, here's my candidates. What are you speaking? Does that make sense? And the response comes back, well, here's what I have. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. 200 okay. Does that all make sense? So the connectivity check, we talked about the five steps. At this point, we get to a connectivity check. So it's going to determine all possible UDP TCP port pairings. Back. UDP TCP port pairings, right? The edge server, it's going to ensure that the edge server can bridge between IPv4 and IPv6. Well, it's going to ensure connectivity. It's going to ask. It's going to ask if Edge server can bridge between IPv4 and IPv6. Stun packets are sent between port pairs in order. Our stun packet's response indicates connectivity. Does the stun packet response indicate connectivity? So you get the 200. That's the response. And then the stop checks when candidate pair has bidirectional connectivity. I'm speaking to you, so we have connectivity. The stun packet response indicates connectivity. You're communicating with me. I'm communicating with you in a bidirectional, right? And that's the connectivity checks, and then we're good to go. So candidate promotion, it's going to select the highest order candidate with a validated connectivity. It's going to select IPv4. Before IPv6, to enunciate, direct before relay, UDP before TCP. The SIP invite with final candidate pair and SD is going to be in the SDP, session description packet, SDP. The 200 OK is going to come back with the candidate pair in the SDP. So these are these session packets going back, those are SIP messages, they're going to be encapsulated within the SDP. And media is optimal, optimal in the validated path. So in this example, we're doing an inside to outside from a home user. So the home user initiates UDP 3478, TCP 443. And then, in this instance, it's setting up or it's instantiating, looking for those pairs. That's pretty much the same. I think back here we did, So 50,000 requirements. Everybody understand that part? The reference to the, we need a bazillion ports. So I've had this conversation a lot around port implementation, and it's enabling the appropriate amount of ports to facilitate communication for your organization. There's an optimization process that you'll go through, and you can go through to limit or ratchet this down from a security perspective. So back in OCS 2007, the history for this is that we required 50,000 to fit, the 10,000 port range, and for TCP, UDP, outbound and inbound. Then as we marched forward in time, for compatibility reasons, we still need to open those up for backwards compatibility to OCS 2007. So you see in the chart, it's, you know, the source IP for AV Edge service interface. I don't want to go into all that detail. I'm going to bore you with a reading every single bullet item, but this is in the slides and you'll have this for reference. This is what I consider reference. Your source ports, your destination ports. And again, remember, it's a bi-directional communication stream. So when we instantiate that bi-directional communication stream, we're going to choose the best candidates possible to facilitate the communication stream both ways. So optimal port ranges are open. See these two link users, but if they, so in essence, they're not able to communicate with each other, or the port range is open. Okay, I see. So with the port range is closed, yeah, this is an interesting slide with the animation. So I stand behind here. What we're seeing is that there's port ranges open, there's port ranges closed. And what the advocacy here is that if you leave the default port ranges open, you're going to facilitate communication by default or out of the box kind of thing. That's the implication. When you tighten or if you close those port ranges, you could potentially prevent communication and cause a bad user experience. So, and that's my role, is fostering a good user experience. If the user picks up their headset or their phone or what have you and said, tries to initiate that call, gets fast busy, they don't know why. It just, well, Link's terrible. Right? So why did you do this to me? I can't do business now. So are we advocating that you leave the port range open? If it's a requirement within your organization to reduce the number of ports, you just have to go through the testing to make sure that your end users have a good user experience.
So how does that tie in with QoS?
That's a fantastic question. Completely not in the slides, but I'm answering it anyway. How does it tie in with QoS? So it ties in directly with QoS. So your quality of service, there are default ports for QoS, your DHCP tagging. So the advocacy for Link is that your Link, the way that you configure your Link policies for your client policies, are that your clients will tag appropriately the port ranges that you have in your QoS. So you take what you have on your network now, if you already have QoS enabled, and you trust client-side tagging, you configure your Link clients for that in that way so that they're going to tag the packets appropriately, and that way the whole system works. Does that answer your question? So actually, I've done this presentation for QoS as well. We talk about limiting the number of ports. And it is that exercise that you can limit the ports. And this is precisely the testing that I'm talking about, or the configuration I'm talking about. You can limit the number of ports. The only thing that, well, not the only thing, the thing that you need to do is ensure your users can communicate. And by that, you make sure that it adheres to your QoS and that they're not being prevented from talking to each other. Right? So if you have changed the default DHCP settings for whatever your audio and your video are, rather than 46, you change something else, because you can, you just want to make sure that your clients are tagging that appropriately, or else they're going to get best effort. Someone watching Netflix is going to kick them off. Did I answer your question? Edge pool and DNS load balancing and net. I don't see a clock. What time is it? 1:50. Okay. So edge pool with thank you very, by the way. Edge pool with DNS load balancing and net. Here we have a client who's outside, and he's that client. It's interesting. Okay. We have a client who's external. The client initiates a connection through the outer firewall to the perimeter, and it's going to, here's my port ranges, here's 443 for TCP, 3478 for UDP. My internal firewall is going out to the edge to instantiate that communication. So the external user might be behind a firewall outside your organization or outside your control. firewalls must allow hairpin public IP to public IP. So if you're implementing an edge pool, I should have said that in the beginning, if you're implementing an edge pool with DNS load balancing and NAT, these are the things you have to take into consideration. Reverse proxy. Remember at the beginning I was saying, why are we here? And a lot of people are saying, well, gosh, where's TNG? Right? That's what do we do now? All right. Reverse proxy. TMG licensing stopped in November 2012 for TMG. Right? So the question that a lot of customers are having is, what do we do since you've taken away TMG? There's end of life, and where do we go? So what we're going to do is use the reverse proxy that you probably already implemented and is expected to work with Link because the policy is already there. So this slide is, reverse proxy, is reverse proxy a commodity? So by show of hands, a lot of us have already answered this question. So we said, are you enforcing VPN connectivity? You said yes. Those of you who are not enforcing VPN connectivity, reverse proxy. What flavor? In other words, who is your reverse proxy provider? Hardware? NetScalers will work well, yeah. So the whole intent for me asking these questions is that we understand that reverse proxy is being used not just for Link, right? It's being used for other things. And we want to, again, it gets back to that IP, that IT dollar and optimizing the IT dollar so that we can standardize across. So alternatives to TMG. So here's the slide that you guys are looking for, right? So, within this slide deck, there's a TechNet article that will take you to this information. Where do I go from now? So with the release of Windows Server 2008, it's now possible to add an additional component called an IIS application request router, or IISR, to your reverse proxy to handle these kinds of things, and we'll get into that. But what you see here down the bottom is that you have your local area network, your perimeter, and your internet, much like we saw before, and that the traffic that's being provisioned through, this is a better slide, go back, is utilizing this process or the IIS application request routing engine. Oh, it's right there, the link, I mean. So when you click on that link, it's going to tell you prescriptively how you implement that. And I want to say prescriptively. Let me reiterate that. Over the last few years, Microsoft has focused, and by focused, I'm a solutions architect. Anything that I talk to you about, whether it's evangelizing or in the technical sense like this, I have to be able to refer back to that IP on TechNet, and it's going to give you click here, type this, click here, type this, because it is in our best interests that you know how to do those things, right? Rather than say, well, gosh, Microsoft said I could do it, but it's this black box, and they're very secretive and holding all that stuff in. So you'll see me, and more when we come out, you'll see us referring to this information. If you find something that you can't, some kind of prescriptive guidance you don't see on TechNet, let us know. You can send me an email. Again, if I don't know, I'll make sure the email gets routed to the right person. So an additional alternative to TMG is Windows Server 2012 R2 Web Applications Proxy. This is going to be, you'll see this more and more and more and more. We talk about OWA, or sorry, not OWA. We talk about UCWA, UCMA. Web applications, exposing web services on Link, web-based communication services through Link. I gave the example of a bot on the service desk, right? And an authenticated user coming in. So the web application proxy is actually a replacement for the previous ADFS proxy role. And it acts as a reverse proxy and as an ADMS proxy. It is supported. They say it's not qualified, but it's supported. What that means is the product group is still testing it. If it's supported, it works. Qualified means what is the best way to configure it. And they're still producing that IP. And by IP, I mean intellectual property, the TechNet article for it. Again, detailed setup guidance can be found here. So why is this important? The gentleman was referring to perhaps a hybrid environment. Right? We're going to migrate. We have Link 2010 or Link 2013, and we want to migrate to Link online, Office 365. But we still have some things that we want to keep on-prem, so we're going to do a hybrid deployment. This is very important. Two-factor authentication. Who here is familiar with two-factor authentication? Okay. This is perfect. So implementing two-factor authentication is essentially, why? Why would we implement two-factor authentication? It's to better attest or secure, let's say not better secure, it's a better way of attesting the authenticity of the user who's providing those credentials, and we'll get to that. So the two-factor authentication, or I should say multi-factor authentication, remote and internal users use two-factor authentication. It's a way to standardize your authentication process as well as, by show of hands, we talk about direct access. Direct access, anyone implement direct access? Okay. So essentially, multi-factor authentication is a way that you enable your users. Remember the days of SSL, single sign-on, that kind of thing? Well, when you didn't have a single sign-on, even on an internal environment, sometimes you had to put in a bazillion passwords, and your users were saying, why do I have to put my password in over and over and over again? It's really annoying. Well, you might think that's a little thing, but it is really annoying. So two-factor authentication along with SSO are just mechanisms by which you can attest to the validity of the authentication throughout the resources that are attempting to be accessed. So the topology changes that we're going to create a custom web service configured specific to the link. Now we get back to the link with regard to two-factor authentication. You're going to create custom web service configurations on your link pools. You're going to disable common, that was a very bad thing. Should never do that. You're going to disable, I got to walk around. Disable common authentication methods on your directories and your front end and edges. You're going to implement separate pools for users without the need for two-factor authentication. I just scratched that last one. Do or do not, but do not try. I had to throw out Yoda there one time at least, but. My advocacy for you is to, if you're going to implement two-factor authentication, it's a lot easier to do it rather than to isolate and have different user personas that you might, some people need it, some people don't. I personally have not ran into a customer that had a need to implement two-factor authentication except for a significant group of people. So considerations, the Link client does not support two-factor authentication. For features that are dependent on Exchange integration. So for instance, like your unified contact store, that kind of thing. So the impacts, it will impact Link client's functionality. I just said the contact store, changing your PIN, and SharePoint integration is such a skill search. I'm gonna have to walk in front of it again. Nobody tell. So, what's the impact to the end user? So users will be provisioned with a smart card for login, and they'll have to change their PIN. So it says no smart card, no login. There's ways to mitigate through that, right? So I have a smart card at Microsoft, but we have what's called a virtual smart card that I maintain on my devices. So when I log in, I just log in. My virtual smart card logs in, and it's a way that you don't have to constantly sit there and put your smart card over and over and over again. So the added value, you'll increase security. If the plane, and this is getting back to that third bullet, right? So implement separate pools for those that don't require two-factor authentication. My advocacy, if you're going to do two-factor or multi-factor authentication, do it. So these slides were actually reversed. This one, I think, should have been in front. So this is introducing two-factor authentication. So two-factor or multi-factor authentication occurs in a variety of different ways. There's the user, there's what they call inheritance, something the user knows, something the user is, and something that they can, they're empowered for?
User has,
that's right. So, for instance, you know, when I get my smart card, I have my smart card. I know my password or my PIN, right? And so there's a process that you go through in setting up that two-factor or multi-factor authentication. Do you guys know RSA? It's RSA tokens that are extremely secure, where you can initiate a VPN connection using multi-factor authentication. So things to know about two-factor or multi-factor authentication. It requires the July 2013, this is again specific for Link, requires the July 2013 update for Link server and client. It's available for Link server only on-prem today. In the future, that will change. But today, for those of you who are looking at hybrid, or for those of you who are looking at migrating to an Office 365, Link Online kind of thing, if you're doing two-factor, right now it's going to be in the hybrid environment. So it only works with Link 2013 desktop and mobile client. Again, that's today. And there's no solution for Web Exchange services yet today. That would be, it's all or none. But if you say you have Mac clients or you have Android clients that you're going to do two-factor for, that would be, if you are going to implement them and have two-factor, that would be a requirement where you would have multiple.
So are you able to speak on what's coming on the next, or is that still in the air?
Yes. To both of those. So the futures, and we'll get into futures here in a bit with regard to what's coming next. And the thing to understand is Microsoft, much like every other company out there, is marching to the cloud. Ubiquitous consumption and ubiquitous service offering. Saying that, that's like the whole Jedi thing. It's like, what does that mean? That's the answer to your question. We're marching to the cloud, so yes, from a vNext or next gen of product-wise, much of this is applicable. And the things that you see that are where we say like on-prem now, or you hear me say now, but may change in the future, those would be indicators of something that might come out in the next version. Yes, it's very true.
So, if we enable
passive
authentication, it affects our clients, our Link clients, and is a big impact to our infrastructure. Because of the size of our company.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And it's after we are done here wrapping up, get with me, and we'll talk, and I'll put you in contact with some people that can help you out. And so help you out with the futures questions as well as help you out with potential answers today. Exchange, what's Exchange? Background, so client authentication, way back in the day, you know, once upon a time, Initial authentication, Link obtains a Link certificate. It's provided by the certificate provisioning on the front end. Let's just move to the next slide because I don't want to read to you. So here we have a user, and the user is going to instantiate a request coming in. It goes to the edge, goes to the reverse proxy, and hits the Link server front end. The Link server front end replies back with a 401 message. Need more input, right? So, and we're going to establish a TCP and TLS connections going back again through the edge, now through the Link's front end servers. It's going to get a web ticket, and it's going to get a cert provisioning from the web service. So the web ticketing web service and the cert provisioning web service, the thing I just jumped over back here. Okay. So what we're talking about in that slide was that a certificate is revocable by the, well, not that. So the security approach, what we're going to show in the next slide that I just jumped back to, is that the model is going to use web services. Remember when before we were talking, like, where do we go from here? What is our authentication mechanism? The model is going to use web tickets. It's going to use web services off of UCWA, web tickets and cert provisioning service to, let's get back to where we were, instantiate communication back. Right, so we get a web ticket security token. And really, the whole thing about this slide is really busy, but the whole thing to understand is it's group, the color groupings are the communications that are going back. So if you look at your client logs, you'll see these messages going back. So now we have the TCP and TLS, so we have a coming back response coming back to the web ticketing web server, which then request authentication. This is all, I mean, this is behind the scenes, right? This is going back and forth. Then the NTLM authenticates, checks the Kerberos authentication against Active Directory. Active Directory says, yep, he's a person, and they're in good standing. So then the web ticket is, token is offered to the client, and then we establish connection. So again, the very busy slide, but this, have you guys used the new version of Snooper? Okay, I would, the new version of Snooper is with Link 2013. It came out in the June, July release. If you're troubleshooting this and you get a client log, you can use Snooper and it will give you a visual representation, this, and it'll tell you it'll give you like a red X, this isn't happening. So it's a lot more visual, has a better visual impact. Passive authentication, what we briefly touched on earlier, is a new authentication method introduced in Q1 of CY13. And when initially introduced, it was for the Link 2013 PC client. And it's essentially where user count and Link is separate force without a trust. And this is, again, we're trying to get to a point where the service consumer is in the initial reception, I guess, of the initial consumer isn't one like, I have to put my password in 50,000 times. It keeps prompting me for credentials, right? Who's had that keep prompting me for credentials kind of thing? So the Link server gets out of the authentication business at this point, and the server delegates authentication to a trusted security token service. So ADFS redirects to the security token service. Authentication uses form entries in Trident page and can use certificates on device or smart card. Again, this gets back to the two-factor authentication. But this is the passive auth. I think it was what you were talking to. How do we not put in a password? How can I simply just authenticate based on a mechanism? It's set up on the server side. Cannot be client policy. It cannot be client policy because client would only obtain. So clients get their policy through embed provisioning, right? So when they come online, they get how am I supposed to be configured? So that's why we can't set a passive auth through in-band provisioning. Server policy, scope per pool, affects all users and client types. Enable passive authentication, disable Kerberos and NTLM. So authentication, the link client external, this is the TLS DSK. Again, a very busy slide. And the thing to note here is that the process of communication is... Oh, it just went all over there. Okay. Did I go backwards? Authentication, you go this way. I think I went backwards. I did. Passive auth. Okay. So this is where I wanted to go. There we go. See, it's very similar. So authentication, link client external, using two-factor authentication. So here we have our initial request that comes in. Again, it hits the front end. It replies back. It says, okay, I'm going to establish. So it replies back with how we're going to communicate. Then it establishes the TCP and TLS connections and sends a 443 or a GET certificate request to the certificate provisioning web service. Very similar to before. Web ticketing security token is required for web. Then it's going to establish TCP TLS connection. Again, 443, it's going to request the security token. So here's where the redirect comes in. So it's establishing the connection, establishes, so the redirect is a 443 to Active Directory. This is the redirect. So two-factor redirects. And then it goes back with, so that whole middle step, if I could just jump back to the other side, you'll see that whole middle step of communication. This validates against Active Directory through the two-factor authentication redirect, sends back the request, gets the authentication, sends back the token, accepts the token, gives a web security token, and then we're up and running. So the process, and the reason why we're differentiating these out in different slides, is that when you troubleshoot this, or is to understand the messaging going back from a SIP perspective of the authentication mechanism from an external client over link using two-factor. So client experience, you know, what is your user experience within two-factor authentication with link? Using Link 2013 client, again, I jumped ahead when I said smart cards can be physical or virtual. The smart card first step is to be enrolled. So you know, your user stats, your Link client. Okay, so we're separating the user experience from the client, what I have on my PC, what I have on my mobile device. Or I should say the mobile client is what's on my PC. On the mobile client, it's the SIP address, and it presented with a Trident page, which you'll see in a bit, and it's going to enter that information. Let's just get to it. So ADFS and link at a high level. This is, again, what you'll probably see if you would go to TechNet and type in ADFS and link. So here, essentially, what ADFS is, it provides a mechanism to do a certificate-based authentication. There's the ADFS proxy is the service that brokers that connection between your users and external or your external users. You know, as far as the user is concerned, they're talking to an ADFS proxy or ADFS proxy server. And really all this, what we're trying to do is you have the authentication, it hits the perimeter, you have your ADFS proxy, it goes to the internal to your ADFS service, there's authentication. So this is really another diagram of what you would see before in that SIP message or that SIP stack. Does that make sense? And we have the breakdown between internal and external. So your passive authentication experience mobile, what we're going to look for, and this is the Trident page, right? So Trident page from SDS pops up and says, hey, I need some authentication. But you were saying that you're no passwords. You're just going to. So that would be interesting to me. That would be very interesting. I'm not saying, I think it's very doable, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But so once you enter the Trident page, then the individual is online and you have that mobile experience. Anybody see any difference with that mobile? That's interesting. Has anybody seen that mobile client before? Okay. Yeah. So the passive authentication setup summary, and there's the references down below. Again, this is the IP. If you wanted to do this, you'd go to those references and look them up and have the step-by-step. But the key steps, you want to establish a trust partnership from your ADFS to your link servers. You're going to configure your ADFS to support the particular client authentication. On your link server, you're going to disable Kerberos and TLM. Passive authentication, and certificate authentication, so the registrar and the online web service. You're going to configure link server to trust the Federation server name of the Active Directory Federation Services. Grant desired policies to the users. And then ensure auto discovery points to the pool configured for passive authentication. Right? I'm just going to leave it just the provide manual configuration. Just don't do that. That would be my advocacy. And that, ladies and gentlemen, are you awake? Hopefully. Fantastic. So the next few slides are the appendices, and you're going to get this. This is online today for your, that you can have access to. The appendices are going to give you all of the topologies that we were using, the examples. I'm not going to go through all of them, but there's quite a few. In addition, it's going to give you the references to the step-by-step guides to establish any of the, whether it's passive auth or whether it's two-factor. And then coming up in the next presentation, we're going to talk about Office 365, dedicated different environments. The question here remains, though, from externalizing or securing your external communications. Right. So fundamentally, you all are here because you want to understand in a better way what are the ways that we can externalize. How can we enable link to our external users, provide that communication, both authenticated and unauthenticated, and do so in a way that is both secure and reliable. Right, and provides that best end user experience. This information in the slide, and I know we went through it very quickly, because again, there's 57 slides. There's a lot of information in here. Download this, and I'm going to commit myself to say that my contact information is on here. And I probably already said this, but if you have a question that is not answered once you've downloaded it, feel free to email me. Absolutely. And if it's urgent on your part, tell me it's urgent. And I will prioritize it, because at the very beginning I told you I don't sell anything and I don't support anything. My job is to ensure the best end user experience. So I want your users to say, hey, this is pretty cool, right? So the oil and gas platform, when you change the user client to put that red button on because they need their own EMS services instead of dialing 911, that needs to work all the time, first go. That's configured. That's custom. That's something you can do. And that needs to work first time. So that's the stuff that I'm particularly passionate about. But authentication and security is also something I'm passionate about. So I hope this was informational for you. And anybody have any questions at this point? Go right ahead.
I guess we might be a little bit off topic, but we're in the process of moving all of our exchange and everything to the online, so the Link servers are going to be in the cloud.
Okay.
There's not really anything to do from my end to secure the outside connectivity at that point in time, correct?
There is a process that you'll go through from a migration.
Well, we don't have it deployed right now internally, so it'll be new.
Right, but so what you're saying is that you have, and we'll be very specific, you have users that have a user object or account in your internal Active Directory, right?
Right.
They're going to consume a service that is provided from a service provider externally to your organization.
Correct.
There's going to be work that needs to occur that will federate, right, your users.
Well, I've already got the AE sync running, so
okay.
The user accounts have all been moved over there. And whenever I get to a class on that, I got a question on that because new users, it'll put the new users up there, but set the password.
Yeah.
Something's wrong there, but that's outside of Link, and that's what the AE sync.
Yeah.
But outside of that, though, all this other stuff that you've been going over is actually done at the Microsoft site.
Yes. So, well, yes. And again, though, if you're, like, say, for instance, you have a business requirement of two-factor authentication,
yeah.
Remember that that's something that's not supported currently in Office 365.
My users can't remember their one password.
So, it's, and there are deployment guides that when you move your users to Office 365,
yeah.
That not only can you have access to, but there's also, Microsoft will also work with you. Depending on the complexity, I mean, if you tell whoever you're working with, whether it's your TAM or your PFE, whoever you have that's engaged with you, say, you know what, we need help with this.
Yeah.
And don't be shy. Tell them our users are either A, having a bad experience. Are we still recording? Okay. I can say this anyway, because I'm passionate about users, right? So I'm a user advocate.
Right.
If Microsoft cares quite a bit, quite frankly, about your user experience. And, I mean, it just makes sense. Because, again, if you're rolling out Link because you think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you know how much money it's going to save your company, and you know how your users are going to love it, and your users, the very first day, get on, they keep being prompted for authentication. It takes them half an hour, or they just don't get on at all, so they're out for an entire day. It doesn't... They could have the best experience and MOS scores of 4.0 for the rest of their life. That experience is set
right.
In their mind. The seed is planted.
Well, I've already gotten them moving the email up there, too. So they're
right.
Logging into the cloud to get to the email. But they're using the Outlook client to do that. So they aren't actively logging in the client's doing
right.
That stuff for them. I noticed Link does prompt me to continue to keep logging in, though, constantly.
Get with your TAM, get with your PFE, because you can fix that.
Okay.
Absolutely. And that was the devil's in the details. So the answer to your original question was that is what you're going to have to take care of.
Okay.
And my advocacy when I talk to customers is that, in your pilot groups, who here, when you run a pilot, you use your IT staff? Show of hands. Okay. So what I tell people, or my advocacy is when you run a pilot, your pilot should be a subset of your users. So if in your company you say have 500 employees and 10 of those employees are IT, I would say maybe one of those pilot users should be IT. Because you're going to get a much better understanding of the impact that your user base is going to have if you do a representative sample. Your salespeople may use Link in a completely different way than your HR folks or your IT staff. And also your IT staff is kind of enamored or have a protective shell or enamored with
technology.
Yeah, so if it doesn't work, they just used to, okay, well, if it doesn't work, I'll fix it myself. I won't communicate to the people who are implementing that technology, hey, this is broken. And then you don't know that it's broken until you roll it out to a greater populace. And then that seed's planted.
Well, what I was planning on using is let it be intercompany, like we got like 65 users, most of them are going to be using it inside, but I found out a couple of people do currently use Skype for business purposes to talk to clients.
Oh, that's right. You were saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm just debating on whether I want to try to mess with that and ask after I'm sure I got everything that's working right.
So, yes, have them go last.
They just don't know they have it.
So, I'm not divulging anything by saying, well, have them go last. I'll just say that.
Right. Isn't Skype
linked?
Maybe Link will be Skype.
Branded.
It'll be the same product, right?
Branded. They're merging somehow.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, Link for Business. I'm sorry, Skype for Business.
So is the client going to be, is it going to be the same client that's going to service the normal Skype we have now, Skype for Business? Is this going to merge the product? Is it going to be one client? Or is it going to have like a business one and just have a normal one?
That's a great question, and it's actually one I can't answer. So, yes. Skype for Business will be, it will look very similar, but it's going to be a different, it's very much like if you're to do Link Web Access now, right? If you're an anonymous user, you have the ability to join a conference by going over the web, but the experience is different than if you had an actual Link client, see? So that experience is a representative sample of what it would be standard Skype, like the one my mom uses, or if you have Skype for Business. To answer your question.
Whenever I started rolling this out, I was just thinking about people communicating through, IM instead of yelling across the office.
So, what's interesting is, are you familiar with Six Sigma, Kaizen? So, my background is Kaizen, which is a competitor to Six Sigma that came out of Toyota Corporation. Rapid process improvement, so RPIW workshops, that kind of thing. And I'm a little long in the tooth, as they say around here. I go back to NT4Ds. Back in the 90s kind of thing. So my first iteration, my first work with this product was LCS 2005. And I was working as an enterprise architect for an insurance company. And we had business advocates that were working with the board. And the board, I was brought up to explain the strategy and the statements of direction I was putting towards how we're going to enable communications moving forward our next 5 years. And one of the directors said, why do you want me to spend $3 million on something that my daughter uses at home? And my initial response, my knee-jerk response, is that your daughter's going to be our employer of tomorrow. But I wanted to show him more than I wanted to say it to him, because I think it was more impactful. And it just so happened that this particular insurance company had Kaizen as a corporate pillar. They had a whole organization within the company that had RPIWs every single week. And so if you're not familiar with rapid process improvement workshops, you get different people together and they all come together and set that aside. They take pencils and paper and they measure with time. It's called tack time. They measure what it takes a certain individual to do something. So in this instance, they were CSRs. And just a quick story. The CSRs are the ones that there's a health insurance company, and their business is paying claims. And so their greater ability to pay claims, the more profitable they are, because the margin is very small. The example that I used when I talk about this is that if a claim that gets booted out of the system, the auto adjudication system, would be, I go to my doctor submits a claim to this health insurance company for a pregnancy test. I'm a male, that's going to get kicked out of the system, right? It should just auto not pay it, right? Auto refuse, but it got kicked out. And so what it means is a human being has got to take that claim and approve it or deny it. The process that we found out was that the CSRs take those, they put them in a queue rather than ticketing system, they put them in a mailbox. This is in 2005, right? And then 2007. Anyway, so they put them in a mailbox and it took a discretion authority, right? So someone who knew about pregnancy, someone a specialist in that area, could be a nurse, but that they had to authorize or deny it, then the CSR could say no, put it back in the system, and the claim would be denied. That process, from time it gets kicked out to yes or no, took on average 21 days. So when we introduced instant messaging for LCS, that's it, just IM, we enabled the CSRs to have IM, and we enabled the nurses and doctors with IM. The time it took for manual adjudication was went from 21 days, it was reduced 96%. 96%. And so when we took that to the board, they said, well, why are you standing here and why have you not done this already? Right? So the guy who said, why are you asking me to spend $3 million on a solution that my daughter uses to chat with her friends, went to, oh, I see the business use for that. So it's a no-brainer. Let's go do that. And so that's, I say all that to get the juices flowing, right? Understand how they're going to communicate. And then I'll leave off with this, is that I was at a Gartner symposium for unified communications in 2008. And the CIO of the University of Kentucky was there. It was a big, tall, white-haired guy. And were you there? Anyone there? So here's the brilliant part. So there's about 250 of us in the audience. And he said, first thing is that my students think you're all so old you should be dead. And we all laughed. Because he was obviously older than us. And the second thing he said was, my students of today are your employees of tomorrow. And they've already figured out ways to communicate and collaborate in methods and ways that, one, you don't know about. So they're going to come to your organizations and they're going to do one of two things. They're going to install it themselves, or they're going to leave and go somewhere where they can be productive. So all of that boils into my advocacy of today, which is provide your users or your service consumers with the ability to communicate and collaborate the way they want to from where they want to. And in doing so, you're going to drive your business. It's not simple, but it's effective. Thank you all very much.